Good morning. The open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for the 26th of May, 2022 will come to order. We have a late submitted document. Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the commission may consider the late submission of agenda document number 22-17-B.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Is there any discussion of the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion is carried unanimously. We have three matters in our agenda this morning, two of which are proposed interim final rules. Mr. Knopf, if you'd be kind enough to introduce the first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, commissioners.
Morning,
sir. Before you is a draft interim final rule that would conform the commission's independent expenditure reporting regulation to the decisions of the United States District Court for the District of Columbia and the United States Court of Appeals for the DC Circuit in Crewe versus the FEC. The regulation at issue was found to be unlawful under the Administrative Procedure Act because it contained a phrase that substantially narrowed the statutory provision it was designed to implement. The draft interim final rule before you would strike that phrase from the regulation in accordance with the court's decisions. Thank you, and I'd be happy to address any questions.
Thank you very much, Counselor. Colleagues, any questions to the Office of General Counsel or discussion? Mr. Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think there's any question that both the commission is going to abide by the Supreme Court's opinion. This came before us in an unusual fashion, although Mr. Knopf was kind enough to make a presentation. The document was drafted in the commissioner's office. And I cannot recall another instance where. I'm sorry. I'm jumping ahead. Wrong rule. I've got something different to say about this one. I apologize. Save that thought. I will bring that up later. This one I thought was going to be uncontroversial. My apologies. I expected this to be completely uncontroversial, and I expected to be supporting the interim final rule in this case. But the my office received rather unusual ex parte communication about 15 minutes before the meeting was due to start from Crewe, which was involved in the underlying litigation. And they have indicated that they would like to file a comment. And while I didn't think it was controversial, and as I said, I was planning on supporting it. If somebody wants to file a comment, I am always willing to hear what the public has to say. So I would request that we postpone voting on this until the next meeting in order to allow that comment to be filed.
Commissioner, for the discussion, Commissioner Cookson.
I guess a question for Mr. Knopf, which is, while this is an interim final rule, is it not the case that the public has the ability to submit comments while the rule is pending?
Yes, they do. Now, the commission normally would not consider such comments until after the rule were to go into effect. It could later decide to reopen the rule because once it goes into effect, it's final. It's called an interim final rule, but it's final as soon as it goes into effect. And we estimate that this will go into effect on around September 30th, which is when it appears that 30 legislative days will be up. So the way I think it would actually wind up working is that, you know, if the commission approved this today, there would be a 30-day comment period. We would receive comments such as the one that Crewe wishes to file. And then the rule would go into effect around September 30th. And then if the commission in that time period had considered this comment or other comments and decided that it wanted to make some changes based on it, it would reopen the rulemaking and make whatever changes the commission deemed necessary.
And if I could continue, Mr. Knopf, this document was put on the open meeting agenda a week ago. Is that right? This isn't a late submitted document.
I believe that's correct, yes.
Thank you very much. I mean, Mr. Chairman, for those reasons, I think if Crewe has something to comment, they have an opportunity to comment. They had ample opportunity the last 7 days to submit a comment, as the public does, and as we're required to, usually those documents under the Sunshine Act. I'm also interested in what they have to say, but I think this train is leaving the station on time, or should leave the station on time, and I think we should proceed with it.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Broussard?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can appreciate that we want the train to run on time, but I want the train to get to the right place and the right road. So I don't think the request for a comment, even though I find this to be incredibly frustrating that it's coming in this moment and this late, I think we should be considering it. So while I am a co-sponsor, for lack of better words, on this one, and I fully support the intention of it, I do agree with the request to hold it over. I don't think that the changes are going to be that hard for us to make, because it's going to be basically tracking the statutory language. I'll ask OGC if they think it would be a card fix. I'm not sure if you've had a chance to review that.
We haven't. Sorry.
Go ahead, Counselor.
Sorry. We haven't really had a chance to review the substance of the comment. We were, you know, we just got it a few minutes ago. Just like,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. With that, and without the ability for our council to be able to give me that additional assurance about what's going on here, I agree and would ask to hold this over.
So three thoughts. One, as Mr. Knopp noted, you know, that the purpose of this procedure is to move quickly to comply with a court order while leaving to a future date. And I think this is something we will need to do a proper rulemaking that would address any ambiguities created in the regulations by complying with the court order. Again, the way this is set up procedurally is that comments come in after the rule is adopted, are then considered, and then a rulemaking would be opened in due course. So I don't see a last minute request for commenting as quite proper under this approach to the rule. I'll also say, you know, I find it very curious that council would try to delay the commission complying with a court order in a case they won. Like, that just strikes me as very strange. And frankly, I think it's unprofessional for council to be reaching out to individual EAs the day of, rather than sending things in appropriately. And so, just practice point for anyone who's listening to this, who practices in front of the commission, we do want to hear from you, but there are ways to do it. And this is not it. So we'll put this document as an ex parte communication on the public record. As a matter of collegiality, we'll hold this matter at the request of two commissioners, even though I don't think this is proper. And I hope the rest of the public will avail itself of the time that's been bought by council's delaying tactic. Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. And I just want to be very clear that this was a total surprise to me, too. I in no way invited this ex parte contact that came to my staff. And I, too, would appreciate it if comments would come in the regular order.
Any further discussion on this matter? Well, with a heavy heart, we will hold this till the next open meeting. The next matter on our agenda is another proposed interim final rule regarding the repayment of candidate loans. Commissioner Cooksey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Before the commission is a draft interim final rule making necessary changes to our regulations in light of a court decision. The Supreme Court's decision 10 days ago on May 16th in Federal Election Commission versus Ted Cruz for Senate. The court held by a vote of 6-3 that Section 304 of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002, placing limit on candidates' ability to seek repayment of personal loans to their authorized committees, violated the First Amendment and is unconstitutional. And that was an affirmance of the unanimous three-judge panel ruling in the District Court for the District of Columbia, reaching the same holding. So in light of that, because the underlying statute is unconstitutional, our implementing regulations, I think, are as well. And so what this IFR does is pretty simple. It removes the implementing regulations, which there are only a handful, from the Code of Federal Regulations in compliance with the Supreme Court's ruling. This is a draft IFR that came from my office, but it's been reviewed multiple times by the Policy Division. In fact, it's had significant input from the Policy Division. And I especially want to thank Mr. Knopp for all of his tremendous expertise and help that went into crafting this proposed document and vetting it. I think this is an important rulemaking. I think it's timely. We're in an election year. We had primary elections 2 days ago. We had primary elections several weeks ago. We have more primary elections coming up. And then, of course, the general election in November. And a lot of campaigns and candidates are going to be wondering what the limits are on their ability to repay personal loans to their committees. And while I think it's safe to say that well-funded, well-counseled committees will probably understand what the rules are, I think that there are many unsophisticated candidates who may not. And part of being clear and giving good guidance as an agency overseeing this area of law is making sure our regulations reflect the state of the law. For all those reasons, I think this is a simple thing we can do. I think it would be good to do it in a timely manner rather than waiting months or years, as I think we have done in the past with other rulemakings in response to court decisions. And so for that, I would urge my colleagues to support the interim final rule.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Broussard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do think it's important for us to issue an interim final rule for this and the previous matter. However, and I've expressed this concern outside of the meeting, is that I think that this should have been fielded through the regulations committee so that we can prioritize the resources of the agency in that division, which is fully understaffed, overworked, and overtaxed. And we all agree they're excellent, but they can only do so much. So this is one that I think if we prioritize what we should be working on and focusing on internet disclaimers and candidate salaries and what we just previously considered, I don't think it's the appropriate time for us to be working on this one. And we do have a Supreme Court decision that I doubt that anyone is going to ignore. Thank you.
Of course, Commissioner. Commissioner Weintraub, I think we may have a sense where you're going.
Yes, indeed. Sorry about that. I jumped the gun on this one. It's very enthusiastic. I agree with my colleague, Commissioner Broussard. I think that we should refer this matter to the Regulations Committee, which is very well led by the chairman and Commissioner Broussard, and they can consider this in light of all of our other rulemaking priorities, of which there are many. There are many things that I have been trying to get my colleagues to focus on for years, and sometimes it's hard to get people to read a document. But as I said, there's no question that we're going to abide by the Supreme Court decision. I think it's highly unlikely that there are too many unsophisticated candidates out there who will not be well counseled, but they have more than $250,000 to loan their campaign. I think anybody with those kind of resources is going to hire a lawyer. And the Supreme Court opinion obviously has gotten wide publicity. So I don't think anybody's going to be too confused about this. Obviously, we should get our regulations in order. I support doing that, but I support our ordering our regulatory priorities through the normal process.
So a couple of responses. First, and the existence of this particular procedure is precisely for these sort of situations. I mean, right now we have a booklet, some of us have it in front of us up here, which has the regulations that purport to speak with the rule of law on the Federal Election Campaign Act as enforced by this agency. That book is affirmatively misleading. The first rule of the rule of law is the law must be public. This is Code of Hammurabi stuff. This is a very ancient point. And to have a situation where we are republishing regulations that are affirmatively wrong on the law as enforced by this agency, I think is very troubling. It's one reason I'm very disappointed that our efforts to put an interim final rule on the previous matter, a case with which I have some personal disagreements, but where the courts have spoken and our rules are unenforceable. I feel the same way here. I agree with my colleagues that resources are at a premium here, and I agree that people know what the law is in light of the Supreme Court ruling, but I don't think that absolves us of our responsibility as a federal agency to ensure that we're not at least putting out, again, affirmatively misleading text, and to act as quickly as we possibly can in situations where it's clear a final order of a court has invalidated our regulations. So you know, with respect, I do think that this procedure exists precisely for this situation. I would understand the need for further rulemaking in light of comments that come in afterwards, but we meet the legal requirements to move quickly to comply with this court order, and I'm going to vote accordingly here, and I would have voted accordingly in the previous matter. So I'm hoping this passes, because I do think, again, we have an affirmative duty to the American people not to to publish inaccurate regulations. Commissioner Cooksey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a couple points in response to my colleagues. I agree that resources in the policy division are at a premium. I initially asked the policy division to draft this from a blank slate. A commissioner objected to my request to have the policy division do that, so I did it in-house. I did it myself, and so I think I'm being respectful of the policy division's very busy time by managing this draft myself and asking for their technical assistance and their expertise in doing it, but you know, allowing them to do the work that is the general work of the commission that we want them to focus on. At the same time, you know, I think we can walk and chew gum. We can do internet disclaimers, and we can do IFRs that are fairly simple, only a few pages, that conform with court orders. I don't see why one interferes with the other, and sort of, you know, we are where we are. It's a completed document. I haven't heard any objections to the substance of the document, that it's erroneous or technically wrong. It just seems like it needs to go through a process that would result in the exact same document we have before us. So if anything, I think the argument in favor of resource conservation is to vote on this document today rather than to allocate additional policy and commissioner time to go through it, unless there are substantive objections to its content.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I am happy to state publicly that I was the person who objected, because the request to have the policy division start drafting came before the Supreme Court had ruled. And my objection was that we should wait until we had the opinion in hand before we started drafting. And I hold to that. Had we waited till we had the opinion in hand, had my colleague said, now should the policy division take a look at this, I would have been happy to go along with that. But as I said, I cannot recall another instance ever where the commission was asked on 1 week's notice to adopt as an interim final rule, but yet a final rule, a document that was prepared in one commissioner's office. It's been undergone one round of revision already since it's been out in the 1 week. So yes, I think we ought to take a little bit more time to make sure that we get it right. And as I said, to make sure it's been properly vetted and gone through the normal process.
Commissioner Cooksey.
I guess a question for Mr. Knopp in the policy division. Do you feel that this rule has had sufficient time with you and with other people in the policy division as needed to vet its contents and its technical conformance?
We've taken a look at the drafts and would support draft B.
Thank you very much. Mr. Treanor.
So my concern in waiting is just a practical concern for practitioners in this area. By having a statute that's been struck down by the court and still having a rule in place, I think it puts lawyers in a tough spot when advising clients as to what sort of compliance they need to be worried about, because it gives the appearance that the commission, especially now that we have this draft out there, that we're having this discussion in public, give the appearance that there may be some attempt to either resurrect or revise the current regulation. And so I think we put the lawyers in a very tough spot in advising clients. So I would urge us to move quickly on this, to get it done, especially in light of, you know, we just had primaries in Texas. We've got primaries going on in other states over the next few weeks. We have a lot of people who are looking at this issue. And while Commissioner Weintraub is correct that, you know, anybody that has this kind of money probably has the ability to go and seek counsel, I worry about what type of counsel they may receive because there is a statute that's been struck down, but a rule that's still on the books. Thank you.
Of course. Commissioner Weintraub.
Just point out that the statute has been struck down, and yet it is also still on the books, literally. Congress has not rushed in to wipe the statute off the books, and we understand that lawyers are going to understand that statute doesn't apply anymore, even though if they look at the statute book, it's still going to be there. And I think similarly, nobody's really going to be terribly confused by this. And I assume that we will get to dealing with this in due course. I'm planning on abstaining on what I assume will be the motion to adopt, because I assume that at some point we will adopt something similar to this, but I do not think that this is the day or the time.
Well, with some hope that we can act with more alacrity than Congress. Is there any further discussion before we take motions? Are there any motions? Commissioner Cooksey. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oh, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Is there any benefit to putting this off for a very short period of time to consider really the merits or demerits of voting at this time? Or are we pretty much locked in?
I haven't heard a lot of ambiguity, Mr. Vice Chair, but if any of my colleagues disagree that a vote today is appropriate, we open to argumentation. Seeing a lot of silence in some cases here, Mr. Vice Chair.
Wouldn't be the first time.
Commissioner Cooksey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to the proposed interim final rule on the repayment of candidate loans, I move approval of agenda document number 22-17-B.
Thank you, Commissioner. For any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Any abstentions?
Abstain.
So Vice Chair, how do you vote?
I abstain too.
Motion fails with 3 in favor. Myself, Commissioner Cooksey, and Commissioner Traynor, and 3 abstentions, the Vice Chair, Commissioner Weintraub, and Commissioner Broussard. All right, thank you very much, Commissioner Cooksey and Council. Move on to what I hope will be a less controversial and more satisfying result. The next matter is Draft Advisory Opinion 2022-05, the DFCC. I believe we have Ms. Lopez here, counsel for the requester. Welcome, Counselor.
Good morning, Commissioner.
And Mr. Morrison, I see.
Good morning, Commissioner.
And Ms. Ballstriker is here at the dais with us for the Office of General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 22-18-A is a draft response to an advisory opinion request submitted by DFCC and National Political Party Committee. The SEC plans to hire a consultant to write a research book about a sitting Republican U.S. senator in a particular state, which it refers to as State A. The SEC will pay a fee of $30,000 for the research book and its copyright. After reviewing the research book and using the information contained in it to inform the SEC's own political strategy in State A, the SEC plans to provide the book in full to the authorized committees of 2 candidates for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate in State A. The SEC plans to offer the authorized committees the choice of paying DFCC for the book, treating the value of the book as an in-kind contribution from DFCC, or treating the value of the book as a coordinated party expenditure by DFCC. The SEC asks whether the value of the research book to each authorized committee is $10,000, one-third of the amount it will pay the consultant. The draft concludes that the value of the research book to each authorized committee is the usual and normal charge for the research book and any associated copyright license in the market from which they ordinarily would have been purchased. We did not receive any comments on the request. We received 7 comments on the draft from individuals and 2 comments from the requester.
Thank you, Counselor. Colleagues, any questions for the requester or the Office of General Counsel? Ms. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to give the requester a chance to comment on the draft. I have to say that I do find the draft somewhat counterintuitive. It doesn't strike me as immediately obvious that three political committees couldn't share the cost of producing a document like this in book form if they so choose. That now what is counterintuitive sometimes is the law, so that's not a good way to make decisions, but I gather that the requester has a different point of view on this, and I would like to give them a chance to weigh in.
Our intuition, of course, is that it's individual. Council?
Thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Chairman. So I want to start by explaining what brought us to seek this opinion, because I think that might be helpful in framing this. And I don't know all of you, but I've come before you at least once before. So you know I've been a practitioner in this space for a long time now. And I came forward to the commission due to genuine confusion over the answer here, right? As practitioners in this space, we try very hard to read the statutes, the regulations, past commission advisory opinions, and we do the best to advise our clients. We make hard decisions every day. And this is one where I really just didn't feel comfortable advising the client without coming to the commission, because I think the advisory opinions that are laid out in draft A are not necessarily consistent. You can find a way, I think, to read them consistently, but there's confusion. And one of my issues, I believe, with draft A is that I think it takes an overly technical reading of the law and writes out the facts of the old advisory opinions to reach a conclusion that I also will just say, quite frankly, I don't think answers the question for the client. If I walked out of here today with draft A, I still don't think I would know what do I tell my client is the value of this book. And that is because the DSCC, right, under the facts presented in the plan, will go to a consultant and they will own the copyright to this book. The two candidates that get it are not going to own that copyright. So it is not that I can tell them, yep, the value of that is $30,000, because there is no usual normal charge for the exact same book and the same copyright license. That's not what they're getting. They're getting the right to use the book for their own purposes, sure, but I don't think it's the same. And I will just add that additionally, I read, and you, this was in our comments, but I read the advisory opinions, particularly 1980-38, 1986-30, and 2007-24, very differently than the draft reads them. I'll just go through them quickly. 1980-38 clearly states in the facts of the request and in the commission's opinion that the two candidate committees are going to split the cost of data that they both have full access and use of. And the commission at no point in the response said that's not proper. And it was, in the facts of the published commission opinion. Again, then when you go to 1986-30, I think both the opinion and the subsequent regulations that we note in our comment make really clear that the way to divide the cost of a shared vehicle of transportation is by splitting it. It's proportionate. The opinion doesn't make any sense if you say that they're each going to have to pay the full freight. That would result in the vendor being grossly overpaid by the candidates on the boat. And then again, when you go to opinion 2007-24, which I think of all the opinions is the most similar to our request, where you have a campaign staffer that is working jointly for two campaigns, is fully available to both campaigns, and they're both paying half of his salary. That is half the cost it would have cost them to pay their own staffer, and the commission approved it. So it's really hard for me as a practitioner to reconcile those opinions with draft A. And further, I still walk away from draft A fundamentally not having an answer to my question, and I don't know what to tell my client. And the last thing I'll add, and I truly do apologize for sending in the second comment so late this morning. I was up late last night just thinking, as a practitioner does, on a question they're so interested in. And I found those two opinions from Minnesota, which I think a lot of us know is a, for lack of a better term, an aggressive regulator in the campaign finance space. They're not a state that, you know, throws up its hands and doesn't look closely at the campaign finance system. And Minnesota has acknowledged, the opinions are very old, 2004, that it is proper for two campaigns to split the cost of research that they are equally using, that they have a real legitimate use for. Again, and that was back in 2004. And again, obviously Minnesota is a state level. It is not the federal level. I, you know, fully acknowledge that, but I do think it is instructive to look at how other regulatory bodies have analyzed the same question. So I will stop my long diatribe now and and see if any of the commissioners have any questions.
Thank you, Councilor. And our sympathies, we stayed up late on this one too.
It's kind of how I have fun, you know? Can I say?
I do. Thank you, Council, for that explanation. In reading your response to the draft, I was struck by the portion where you talk about how this could be reported as potentially $90,000 worth of contributions. And obviously, I have real concerns with reporting and making sure that the public has a full picture of what's going on. But your request stated that the committee was purchasing both the copyright and the work itself for $30,000. And yet it was transferring to the individual committee something less than what it had purchased. So clearly it would be less than the full amount that the party committee had purchased. And in that reporting situation, would it not be the case that the party committee was telling the individual candidate committee what the value was? So I was a little struck by how you could get to $90,000. Is it your intention to report the full $30,000, even though you're contributing less than what the party committee fully purchased?
That's an excellent question, Commissioner. And it's one that I'll be frank, I thought about myself. And I think the hard point where I landed where it was, and part, again, why I came to the commission was, if it's not $30,000 and it's not an even split, what is it? Right? Because how do I know? And I did a lot of research contracts, far more than I wish I had to, as a lawyer. And it's hard to know what the value would be if you take away the exclusive copyright license, right? Because you could see the research vendor saying, I'll give it to you for $100 if that means I can go resell it to like 70 other people. And I assume the commission doesn't want the answer to be, I just get to go ask the research consultant, hey, what's the value of this book in the market with no copyright license? They say $100. Now the campaign just pays me $100. If you want that to be the answer, cool with me, totally fine. But I think the reason my struggle with that is I don't know how to exactly value that in the market, because again, it doesn't exist. The practice that I can't speak for other practitioners, but that I've come across is usually you want the copyright license, at least the original payor, because you don't want everyone to get your book. And maybe you're a cash shop campaign and you can't pay a premium for a copyright, so you pay less, but I don't know how to do that in the context of a book where the DSCC does want that license. So I thought through that same thing, but I think it's tricky. And that's why I think the proportional split leads to a much better answer that is clean. It's the regulatory community can figure it out. There's no like hard math we have to do and uncertainty or room, quite frankly, to evade campaign finance law by getting a consultant to say, yeah, $10, while also avoiding reporting the DSCC spending $30,000 on a book and then $60,000 worth of in times. That is very misleading, I think, to the public.
Thank you for the answer. I'm not sure I fully understand. So let's just walk through it very simply. So the party committee is going to purchase the book and an exclusive copyright to the book for $30,000.
Correct.
They are then going to transfer to the individual candidate committees just the book itself, not the copyright to the book.
That's correct.
Correct. And your concern is that you can't put a value on that.
My concern is I don't think the value of that to each candidate is $30,000.
I would agree with that, because the $30,000 had to include the exclusive copyright to the book.
Right. And I don't know how to value a book without an exclusive copyright. And I think it is much more clear, concise, and just as justifiable to say, we'll split it proportionally. Again, looking at the Minnesota opinion as an example of how another agency has handled what is admittedly a thorny situation.
And how is it that the current draft does not give you that? I mean, I think it gives you a very wide range to be able to tell the commission what that value is, does it not?
I don't think that it does. As a practitioner, I'll tell you, I don't feel comfortable advising off the draft. And I'm not shy under any means. My colleague Zachary can tell you that about advising and using my gut when giving counseling to clients, but I don't think that it does because I don't know what the standard means, how to apply it to the situation. And then if you look at the reasoning in the draft, it cites an AO that I've always thought as a practitioner is an outlier. And I really think is inapplicable here. If you look at that, let me make sure I get the number right, 1985-19, the commission was extraordinarily concerned with the prohibited corporate in kind. In fact, they call that the paramount consideration in getting to the conclusion. And I think that's very inapplicable here. And I'm very concerned about this draft as it stands, because I think honestly, it's going to create even more confusion among the regulated community to revive this old advisory opinion that my opinion is it's wrong, not the question before the commission today. But in addition, I just don't think that that opinion is applicable to these facts. I think the other opinions we cite in our request are, and the inclusion and analysis in the draft is just very confusing to me.
Mr. Chairman, but we really don't have to worry about that concern here, though, because we're talking about all hard dollar transactions that are going to be reported, correct?
Exactly.
Okay. I'll let Commissioner. Commissioner Broussard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question that I have is, what would happen if you gave this to a third committee after the DSC has already paid for it and reported it as being split between two committees? What's the in-kind value then? Is it zero?
So that's a very good question. And another one that I also thought of in submitting the request. I will say that's not the scenario before the commission. And I don't think that scenario would be covered by this advisory opinion. And I understand, I completely understand your reaction to that, because of course the commission's goal is to create rules that cover all scenarios. I totally get it. As a practitioner, I would advise that clients figure this out on the front end. And then if it's a third committee, they might have to go back and amend or recalculate. I don't know. I think that's messy, but I don't have a better answer now for how to do this on the front end. So I understand it's complicated. And that's the hard thing about practicing in this space, I think, as we all know as practitioners or regulators, right? That things are fluid and practices change. But what I do know is that this question, I think, comes up a lot and is one that is a lot of confusion. And I think our proposed answer is the best one under these circumstances. And I can't speak to every potential twist of it under the sun.
Commissioner Cooksey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Lopez, for the answers you've given so far. I guess you mentioned just now the AO 1985-19 Valley for Congress, but it's not addressed in your draft and wasn't addressed in your comments. I understand you were given the explicit opportunity to address that AO, but declined. So I guess
to interrupt, but we did not decline. We sent an email back to the commission. It was just a paragraph explaining why we thought that it was inapplicable because of the corporate, the potential for legal corporate in kind.
And then I'll look to counsel about the accuracy of that just because I was told differently.
I'm happy to sign in for the email, if that's helpful.
Counselor.
To clarify, when we said that they declined to address it, that they declined to address it in the request, either to submit a revised request that would address it on the record for everybody to consider.
And not I apologize.
Not that they didn't respond to us.
Let's not talk over each other. Go ahead, Counselor.
We just meant that they, not that they didn't respond to our, suggestion, just that they declined to address it on the record in a revised request.
Ms. Lopez.
Oh, I just meant to say, I apologize for, I think I assumed that the email would go into the record because that has been my experience before with the commission, but I apologize if we didn't make that clear on our end.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Cookson.
I guess back to my original question then, which is, can you, if you have anything else to add about why you think a Valley for Congress is wrong or shouldn't be applied here, it seems on point, at least in terms of the proposal to split a shared resource between a party committee and a corporation, and the nature of the resource is one where it's, it's non-rivalrous. Each committee can get full use of the resource, and the commission declined to approve a cost-splitting proposal.
Sure. So I think I have a series of points. The first being, You'll see from our request in the draft, there are four advisory opinions that deal with use of a shared resource that committees here at Corporation get the full benefit of. That this AO is the only one that says that a proportional share of those costs is inappropriate. So I think it's a strong outlier on those grounds. I also think the reasoning is very different because the commission was viewing the request through the lens of a corporate vendor who is also going to share the resource. And if you read the language of the opinion, it says, and I pulled this quote out because it really struck me. Well, I'll find it. But essentially it says that since the act prohibits a corporate contribution in connection with a federal election, the value of the computer system in this regard becomes paramount. The commission seemed very concerned, and I think in some ways being overcautious in that situation to avoid a prohibited corporate in-kind contribution. I would further say if 1985-19 is the rule and it means that any time an asset is fully is shared and available to everybody, then the commission's travel regulations and the polling regulations would be improper. So I don't think that opinion is consistent either with later advisory opinions or the commission's own regulations.
Commissioner Cooksey. Well, Ms. Lopez, I think that goes to my next question. Your reliance on the regulations with respect to poll costs and travel costs, I think, are actually arguments against your position. They're the exceptions that prove the rule. If your interpretation of the general rule were correct, we wouldn't need those regulations because the general rule would just be you can split costs. But we have special carve-outs for polling costs and for travel. And if you were right, those would be redundant with the general rule. I mean, you agree that this isn't polling costs and this isn't air travel, right? So why then, if you're right, then those regulations are superfluous?
So I don't view those regulations as superfluous. Again, as a practitioner in the field, and you can actually see this in the history laid out on draft day, the regulations cannot possibly cover every question that's going to come before the commission or every iteration of an issue. And you can actually see there's an advisory opinion about a houseboat that the commission acknowledges in draft A is later actually covered by a regulation that the commission subsequently promulgated. So just because regulations exist on a specific topic does not in any way, shape, or form to me as a practitioner in this space for almost a decade tell me that because it's specified for one, it doesn't mean that the same valuation or analysis is applicable to a different set of circumstances. It tells me that that question came up enough that the commission took the time to promulgate a rule on it.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cooksey. I want to make sure I understand the full scope of the logic of your position here. So the proposal is for the DSCC to commission the research book and own the copyright and to give it to two committees for a total allocation of $10,000 to each. By the same logic, if at the same time gave it to three committees, do you think the proper reporting is $7,500 each?
If I gave it to three committees that had a bona fide use for it, yes.
And so if
you gave it to nine— I don't think that you can just like give it away to everyone under the sun. I also would say, to the extent that that's a concern, there is value in a research book not getting into a million people's hands, because it is obviously sensitive.
So would you say then that, say you gave it to 19 different committees, that the value to giving it to the 19th committee is different than the value to the first committee?
So I'll just say I can't imagine a world in which there would be 19 candidates that would have a bona fide use for a DSCC commissioned research book. So I just don't think that's a reality that we'll confront or that's at issue before the commission.
You can't imagine a situation in which a commissioned book of research might be helpful to, say, every Democratic House candidate in the country?
I'm not the lawyer for the DCCC. I'm not here on their behalf. I really just can't speak to that.
Well, so imagine there was a book that the DCCC or the DSCC wanted to give to all its candidates that were running. Is it your view that that needs to be evenly reported based on the division of, you know, whatever it is, 33 or 34 candidates running?
Yes. Which is how polls work. I mean, if a DSCC or DCCC commissioned a poll, because I understand that it sounds radical in the context of maybe something that we've never thought about, but that is how a poll would work.
But we have a special regulation for that, don't we?
Sure. I mean, I can come back to you with a request for proposed rulemaking, but I think the role of the commission is to advise the regulated community as quickly as possible on questions that are very common and existing in real time. And again, and maybe this is just a difference of opinion between the two of us, which is, of course, we're both lawyers and practitioners in this space. It's natural, but I just don't think the absence of a regulation on point means that some moral logic doesn't apply to other circumstances.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Cooksey and then OGC. Thank you very much. I have to say, I also agree with Commissioner Traynor that I found your comment saying that you would need, under this opinion, if it were adopted, you would need to report it as $90,000 is wrong, and the draft doesn't say that. And I guess I'm confused about why this is such a unique and flummoxing problem, because it seems like committees have to deal with this problem all the time in in-kind contributions, right? Certain services rendered or things given, you know, as in-kind gifts to the committee have to be evaluated. And sometimes it's very easy to evaluate that because we have a marketplace and prices and things we can look to what things are worth. Other times it's harder, especially with things like services rendered, right? We come into this all the time when it comes into personal use and discounts and or whether things have been overcharged or undercharged. Some goods and services are easy to price and some are difficult, and the FEC is not the price setting commission. We leave it to the two committees to make good faith efforts to figure out what the appropriate prices are to charge and to report. And I think that that's what this draft does, is it directs committees to engage in that sort of, again, it's a vague process. It's a standard, not a rule, but it directs committees to engage in a good faith effort to do that process, and leaves us out of setting specific dollars and cents for what everything under the sun might be worth to a campaign. So for that reason, I'm happy to support the draft today if colleagues are willing, but if there's interest in more time, I would understand that too. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Of course.
Commissioner, may I ask you a follow-up question on that? I'm sorry.
That's not how this works. Ms. Waldstreicher, were you seeking recognition? All right, counsel, please go ahead. Although you may want to make a point and not ask a question.
I really just want to ask a question, truly. Commissioner, you said that you think that the draft, because again, I'm being very genuine when I say I don't know how to take this draft and advise my client. So I asked the commissioner because it seems to be the view, at least of you, that it is clear and there's a way to do it. How would you do it if you're in my position? How would you then go back and figure out the value of this book without the associated copyright license?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Cooksey, with the caveat that I'm a lawyer, but I'm not the DSCC's lawyer, it seems to me that one reasonable thing that I've seen committees do in the past is talk to brokers, talk to people in the industry to ask for reasonable valuations. We do this all the time in terms of things, evaluating email lists, services rendered, other things like that. It seems to be standard practice, but I leave it to Ms. Lopez. Of course, she's the expert.
Can I ask a follow-up question, just because I think we may be going in a general direction of taking some more time on this. So Ms. Lopez, you may want to think about how you feel about that. But let me ask the question in the hope of narrowing the discussion. You would agree, and that I read the Minnesota regulators, AOs, and the various stuff that was cited. This is a very easy case if there's a joint purchase, correct? What's tripping us up here is the copyright.
I would agree with that.
Okay. So then I guess my question goes to something you said, and look, I'm a litigator. I know you say things off the cuff, and you know, so this isn't a trap. Feel free to explain yourself. But you said, you know, we wouldn't give it out to everyone under the sun. And I mean, that kind of got me thinking because, you know, it seems to me the reason you wouldn't give it out to everyone under the sun is that you reach diminishing marginal returns and the actual value to committees further down the list may be very different from the value to the two committees that came in here. And in fact, that's why you often have joint purchases, so that you know up front that those are the entities that are going to have, they're being able to make, I think, what you call the bona fide need out for the particular piece. So how do you think about that problem as a matter of law? Because I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but you're not the only national committee. And some of them do run a lot of people in primaries, say every 4 years. And it's not hard to imagine a situation where dozens or scores of candidates are involved, I don't know, say in a challenge to a sitting president. So we need to articulate a rule of law here that can extend a little bit further. So I wanted to give you a chance to comment on that tension.
Sure. And I appreciate that. It's one of those things you say and regret as soon as you say it, because you know you're opening a can of worms. I will say where I was coming from is very much from living in Senate world and being the DSCC's lawyer, and that when you commission a research book, right, there's inevitably certain things you're interested in that you have found that you think are good policy topics, whatever it is, right? And there's a lot of value in that. So you want to get it in the hands of, you know, for example, here, your two primary candidates to benefit them. You really don't want it getting around beyond that. Because once a research book starts circulating among 17 candidates, it's basically out in the public domain at that point. Which again, I do think speaks to the valuation decreasing as more people get their hands on an asset. The reason I said that was because in the context of the DSCC, it is just something that is so extraordinary, unlikely. It's not going to happen given the political environment. But I take your point that other committees might be differently situated. But I do think, again, if your research book is being disseminated so widely to that many individuals, I do think the value of that book has gone down at this point.
But the other edge of the sword that I asked you about is the decision, and you know, whatever, you're entitled to structure this however you wish. But the legal ambiguity came in because of the decision not to structure this as a joint purchase by the three committees that are gonna have a bona fide need for it. And that's where, I mean, I think the question was very fairly asked. It's like once you decide to structure it the way that this request is structured, it is possible to imagine 4th and 5th and 6th and 19th and 37th committees getting a non-exclusive license. And so, I mean, I think that's what's at the center of the thing we're struggling with here. And I'm not sure that I have a good answer from your client as to how we're supposed to deal with that problem.
I think that's very fair. And I think the question I would ask back is, why should the valuation be different if two committees, or why should it be improper rather, to split the cost between the number of recipients on under my scenario versus if the DSCC and three campaigns buy it today versus if the DSCC gets it today and gives it to two campaigns a week later? Why should the law value that book differently in that context?
I can think of some answers, but colleagues? Mr. Chair.
Ms. Lopez, would your client be amenable to giving us an extension of time to work on this? And I'm not saying that this may not be the final answer that we get, because there's a lot of support for what is in this particular draft. I think you have raised some questions that I would like to take a look at, but I'm not entirely certain that we're not going to come back with this very soon.
Sure, I'm absolutely willing to. I very much appreciate the commission's consideration of the question and the seriousness with which it's being treated. I very much appreciate it and happy to give you more time.
Thank you. Then, Mr. Chairman, I would request that we hold this over to the next open meeting.
Thank you, Commissioner. For any further discussion, you can hold the council, please.
We'll have to send something in writing to get the extension writing, but could we make it an extension until, I don't know, 1 week after the next open meeting, something to give us time after that date to, you know, get the final draft out and signed and everything, or a couple days after, something like that.
Mr. Trainer?
A 3 week extension, Ms. Lopez, if you could give us that, and I would anticipate some more comments from you in that time frame.
Absolutely, that sounds good.
Thank you, Council. Sorry to give you more late night work.
I don't mind at all. I appreciate, again, the effort.
All right, this matter will be revisited at the next open meeting of the commission. That exhausts our agenda for today. The remaining matters are held over. Mr. Staff Director, are there any management or administrative matters requiring the commission's attention?
Mr. Chairman, there are no such matters.
Thank you very much, sir. We are adjourned.
All right, stand by.